We need to move on to our final session, which is going to be controversies in the medical and surgical management of BPH. We're very fortunate in having Dr. O'Leary with us today. Mike O'Leary is professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School and a senior urologic surgeon at the Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. Dr. O'Leary? That's my case.
Go ahead.
Well, we were going to start with a case. We're running a little short in time.
I won't keep you late.
This is a 48-year-old businessman complaining of nocturia times six, a weak urinary stream, an intermittent but embarrassing urgency. For the past 2 years, he's been on daily tamsulosin, 8 milligrams a day, finasteride, 5 milligrams, Cialis, 5 milligrams daily. His symptoms continue to worsen. His 28-year-old second wife is very concerned, as is he, about the lack of a visible ejaculate if he's going to have prostate surgery. His PSA is 1.1, a transurethral ultrasound reveals a prostate gland of 60 grams with a 30 gram transition zone, and cystoscopy shows that he does have a fairly large protruding middle lobe. What would you advise? And we'll get back to this after Dr. O'Leary's presentation.
Great, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about something slightly different, not quite as sexy as the stuff we were previously talking about, but something that means a lot to us, particularly aging men. I do not have any disclosures. First thing I should talk about is the initial evaluation of lower urinary tract symptoms, because there's a little bit of controversy about this. I don't think there's any question now that we need to use patient-reported outcome measures, and we're using them in most of urology. This was actually one of the first places where they were used, and the AUA symptom score is probably familiar to most people, certainly urologists. Where there's a little confusion sometimes, I find, is in other parts of the world, it's known as the IPSS, or the International Prostate Symptom Score, and that simply is the AUA symptom 7 questions plus the additional bother question. And the International Consultation on BPH adopted the terminology International Prostate Symptom Score and were quick to recognize that the bother score is not at all trivial. In fact, it may be more important than the summary symptom score, because the more a patient is bothered by his symptoms, the more likely he is to progress. So, for example, you have a patient with an AUA symptom score of 25, which puts him in the moderate category of risks, and he has a bother score of 1 or 2, which is the low end of the scale. He is likely to do much better than a patient who has a lower symptom score, say of 17, and a higher bother score. So symptom burden is important, but bother score is equally, or in my opinion, more important. A urinalysis, I think, it should be basic, and in the new guidelines, it is. There is some controversy in the medical literature generally now about a digital rectal exam. Most internists are not doing them anymore. I think most urologists still do them, but there is literature out there that says they're of minimal to no value as a diagnostic tool in prostate disease. I think all of us still do them. I still do. I'm seeing some heads nod here. I mean, I will frequently say to my patients, if I don't do a digital rectal exam, there's really nothing else for me to do. I mean, there's not a whole lot of examining that we do except the genitalia and the rectum. So PSA is somewhat controversial, not in urology. I realize that our guidelines indicate that it is appropriate. Some guidelines in other specialties and in other specialty organizations say it should be a conversation between the clinician and the individual. I think that there's clear evidence that early detection of prostate cancer is valuable. So PSA is done in my patient population in men 50 to 70, and men with increased risk factors above the age of 40. And by increased risk factors, a first-degree relative with prostate cancer, male relative, obviously, and or African-American heritage. Now, the new guidelines, which also just came out, the updated guidelines suggest, and this was controversial to me, that we should consider, that's the terminology in them, should consider assessment of prostate size via ultrasound, CT, MRI, or cystoscopy. The old guidelines said that cystoscopy was unnecessary, and now they're suggesting that ultrasound, and I mean transrectal ultrasound, and cystoscopy should be considered in all men with presenting for BPH and potential treatment. You should perform a post-void residual, which most of us do in the office with a small ultrasound machine, and Uroflow. And those are fairly basic tools to the urologist. But it is new to suggest that patients should consider, or urologists should consider cystoscopy and transrectal ultrasonography. And I'll tell you a little bit why I think that got into the guidelines in just a minute. Urodynamics, I think, are appropriate if the diagnosis is uncertain. And so if I have a patient who has significant symptoms but a good Uroflow, or conversely, a patient with minimal symptoms but a terrible Uroflow and a high PVR, that's a patient I may consider doing urodynamics on. Now, our neurourology colleagues might differ slightly, and when you have a hammer, everything looks a bit like a nail. So people who are doing urodynamics all the time will probably do them more regularly than the average urologist. But I think that they should largely be reserved for diagnostic uncertainty. I think first-line therapy should be with pharmacology. And we'll talk a little bit about first-line therapy, and it'll be apropos to Dr. Lipschultz's case presentation, I think. Alpha blockers, for me, are all the same in terms of their efficacy. The difference is that the dosing is not the same. There's only three of these agents that the dose that's initially recommended is a therapeutic dose, and that's alfuzosin, tamsulosin, and possibly silodosin, although there are two doses. Terazosin and doxazosin are both good alpha blockers, but when I get patients referred by my primary care colleagues, I will find that, and they're on an alpha blocker, presumably for lower urinary tract symptoms due to BPH, I will find out that a lot of them are on homeopathic doses. So they're on 2 milligrams of doxazosin or a milligram of terazosin. Those are homeopathic doses. So the dose of terazosin should be 10 to get to therapeutic level, and it needs to be titrated because of the potential for hypotension. And doxazosin should be 8, and alfuzosin, it comes in the dose that is therapeutic. Tamsulosin, the therapeutic dose, at least the manufacturer says 0.4 milligrams, but more than 20% of the men who take tamsulosin, according to the pharma data, take 2 tablets. Which your guy was taking. He was taking 0.8 milligrams. And they do that on their own because they discover if one is good, 2 is better. Not always the case, but if they think so, it's fine with me because the drug is generic now, so it's cheap. What about the role of 5-alpha reductase inhibitors? We have 2 of them, finasteride, dutasteride. For my money, they're dutasteride is no different really than finasteride is. I realize it has both type 1 and type 2 AR inhibition, but it's no better. Finasteride has been around for a long time. They're both reasonable agents. The question is, when should they be used? And then finally, PDE5 inhibitors. Tadalafil has a 5 milligram dose that has a label indication for the treatment of lower urinary tract symptoms. I don't think the efficacy is quite what the alpha blockers are, but it has the additional benefit of promoting erections at least to some degree. So monotherapy versus combination therapy. The medical treatment of prostate symptoms trial, which is over a decade old, now clearly demonstrated that the combination of an alpha blocker and a 5-AR inhibitor is better than either drug alone. problem is to get a patient to take two pills. It's not always easy. Does come in a branded, what is it called, Jalen? Jalen is the combination drug. It's not cheap, but you can prescribe generic tamsulosin and generic finasteride for a lot less. You just got to get them to take both. What about an alpha blocker and an anticholinergic? I think there's clear benefit to them. And 10 or 15 years ago, people would have said you are crazy to put patients on those two medications, but there have been clinical trials that show in patients who have significant urgency, significant frequency, may benefit from having an anticholinergic added to an alpha blocker. And then finally, an alpha blocker plus a PDE5 inhibitor. I'm not sure the PDE5 inhibitor is going to improve the efficacy, but there are plenty of patients who are taking both. There is a label that says that they shouldn't be taken at exactly the same time. I don't think it applies for vardenafil, though. So what about surgical treatment as first-line therapy? That was probably not discussed a lot in the past. People would most agree that a pharmacologic intervention is appropriate before trying a surgical one. But now with so-called minimally invasive treatments, it may be considered appropriate for first-line therapy. But there are certain circumstances in which, at least I believe, that surgical treatment should be considered as a first-line therapy, and that is in patients with recurrent urinary retention. Certainly patients who have renal insufficiency, very high post-void residuals, those patients should probably have urodynamics, and then if they have reasonably good bladder contractility, should be considered good candidates for an outlet obstruction relief procedure. If not, they should be on clean intermittent catheterization. Patients with recurrent UTIs, I think that may be a reasonable indication for surgery as a first line. And obviously, if patient has significant outlet obstruction and bladder calculi, that's a good reason to go in their bladder, take care of the prostate, and take care of the stones at the same time. So these are some of the minimally invasive surgical treatments that we're reading and hearing about more now. And they are being offered and marketed by the companies that manufacture them as alternatives to pharmacology as first-line treatments. Transurethral microwave thermotherapy. I think I heard Abe say that he still does tunas. You do? I don't think there are a lot of people that do, but that's transurethral needle ablation of the prostate, and that's a radio frequency. One of the new ones that a lot of patients know about is the so-called UroLift, which is a little device that's inserted into the prostate. It springs open, and it actually opens the prostatic urethra. Resume, which is another minimally invasive device. I've done a number of these. I'm not completely convinced that they can be done on someone without some sedation, because even with a good prostate block, it's pretty uncomfortable when you put your foot on the gas and it or the trigger, and it injects this blast of hot water, they jump off the table, sometimes even with a good prostate block. That's been my experience. This, next to the last one, aquablation, is very intriguing to me. This is a brand new device, robotic, transrectal ultrasound guided. A transurethral tube goes in, and this is a truly robotic procedure. The surgeon controls the entire ablation of the prostate with a robot and transrectal. And I think we may be hearing more about this in the future. It's a very expensive device. I mean, I looked at trying to buy one, and my business people went nuts. But and then finally, urethral stents. And there's one in the pipeline that, if it gets FDA approval, will revolutionize the treatment of BPH, because it can be introduced through a flexible cystoscope. So a urologist could do that in the office. You simply slide the scope in, this thing expands, and they're also removable. You'll hear more about that. It's still in clinical trials in other parts of the world, but it's coming to the US soon, I think. Traditional therapy for big prostates, for large prostates, but less than 90 grams, I think. Transurethral resection of the prostate, I just did two this morning before I came here. It is still a very good operation. It really, first of all, it's very satisfying when you get done with one, but those patients do well. I tell patients that 80% of them will have a 50% reduction in symptom burden, and that's pretty satisfying. Green light lasers are being done in some places. I think that's less than it was a few years ago. It's not quite as popular. Transurethral button vaporization of the prostate, which is just another form of heat treatment. And then an underutilized treatment modality, I believe, is a transurethral incision of the prostate, which works very well for patients without big glands and younger patients, because you can retain antegrade ejaculation more with a TURP than with a TURP. And I think it's an underutilized procedure. Also sometimes referred to as the Orandi procedure, based on a urologist who reported a large series a number of years ago. Large glands, open simple retropubic or suprapubic prostatectomy, still a reasonable operation, but slowly being replaced, I think, by procedures such as the holmium laser enucleation of the prostate, or HOLEP. We can't do those at our institution because it requires a tissue morselization, which is controversial. Robotic-assisted LAP simple. All of our robotic prostate surgeons have learned to do these and like doing them. They had to learn from some of us because they're younger guys who've never seen a retropubic prostatectomy, or certainly not a suprapubic prostatectomy. And I remember taking one of our really good prostate surgeons, I just sat down on the other console, and I said, no, just right here, right? You know, this is where you go. And it works. They work really well. And then finally, another controversial procedure that I don't think should be controversial, because I've seen it work. Both our institution and the Mass General are now doing prostate artery embolization. It's still, the guidelines say it should be considered investigational. I don't believe it's investigational. Right now it's being done by interventional radiologists, not urologists, because we don't normally have the skills to find tiny little arteries and inject them. But for patient debilitated men who can't undergo a surgical procedure, or men who have to be anticoagulated, particularly older guys with these really large vascular glands that just bleed like hell all the time because they're on an anticoagulant, this thing actually works. I'm convinced of it. So.